everyone. My name is Beth Hannon and I'm the Associate Director of the Forum, and I'd like to welcome you all to the first event of the new term here. I'm delighted to see so many people out in such a miserable January. The Forum is a non-profit organisation devoted to putting on philosophy events for the general public. They're free to attend, they usually don't require any registration, and we hope that you'll find them very accessible and enjoyable as well. This event is being recorded for a podcast, so if you do ask a question during the event, make sure you wait for the roving mic to find you so that your voice is picked up by on the recording. And if you could turn off the volume on your phones, that would be fantastic. No need to turn your phones off. You're welcome to tweet along. We have our own hashtag, which is somewhere, LSEFEP. If you want to tweet along with us, that's fine. Our work, as I say, we're a non-profit organisation, and that, so our work is made possible by the generosity of our donors and the support we get from the LSE, and so we're incredibly grateful for that. If you'd like to be one of those donors who makes this possible, you can find a Just Giving link on our webpage. And if you go there, you'll also find an archive of podcasts as well as essays by contemporary philosophers on topics of current interest. Okay, that's it from me. I'm going to hand you over to Peter, who will chair the event tonight. And again, thanks so much for coming.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to this forum event on the nature of money. My name's Peter Dennis, and I teach in the philosophy department here at LSE. We've gathered together a really eclectic panel, so I'm really excited about our discussion tonight. To my left is Philip Goodchild. He's Professor of Religion and Philosophy at the University of Nottingham. Next to him is Susan Steed. She's the co-founder and former director of the Brixton Pound, and she has academic affiliations at the New College for the Humanities and the University of Bristol. On my far left, we've got Valtraud Schelkler, who is assistant professor of political economy here at LSE. We're going to start off our discussion with quite a classical philosophical question, but I think the most fundamental one, which is simply, what is money? And I'll ask Susan if you can go first.
Right. So, hello, it's such an intimidating question. What is money? So I thought I'd ask a slightly different question, which is, what is it that first made you question what is money? And for me, I can remember quite clearly when I first started questioning it. It was when I was very young, as a child, and one of my favourite toys was this pretend till. I don't know if anyone else had one. And I had like my own pretend shop where I'd basically make up the prices, make everything up about the economic system. And this is how I thought money worked when I was younger. And then, of course, we grow up, we're socialised into thinking about money in very specific ways. We learn that people have a lot of money and we kind of accept it. We kind of sometimes believe that our money or our worth comes from what we do for a living. And this is kind of some of the ways we think about money. We accept it. But then maybe about 10 years ago, I had a realisation that actually what I thought money was when I was a kid was right all along, really. Somebody's just made it up. And it's quite haphazard the way money is created in the economy, I think. This is quite an empowering realisation on some levels. So it led me to get involved in two different projects where I thought we could create our own money. So the first one I did was I used to work in housing and worked for a housing association that ran a time bank, which is where you create a currency that's denominated in hours of time and you trade in time. The next currency I got involved with is the Brixton Pound, which is slightly less radical in that it's linked to sterling, but again, it's trying to change the way money works by making a currency that it isn't able to accrue interest on. We're trying to make money that you can only use for exchange. So these two practical projects. And I suppose from doing those, I began to think that money is really all about trust. And I think one of the most empowering things about doing these projects was that when we created the Brixton Pound, small businesses in Brixton trusted our currency and were able to use it. However, the question that's kind of preoccupying me at the moment is why we're so willing to trust other currencies. So specifically, why are we so willing to trust US dollars, despite the fact that in 2008, a global economic crisis, which originated in America, nothing bad really happened to the dollar. And even despite the fact that quite recently we've had a quite questionable president elected, and people still willing to trust the dollar. So that's really the question that I'm pondering, is not just what is money, but what is it that gives some currencies so much power and why we accept them so willingly?
Valtrad, let's turn to you.
I mean, I find it quite helpful how Susan talks about it. I was and am an economist to some extent. I'm more political economy now, but I have always worked and was always fascinated by money. This thing that has no intrinsic value in itself, but seems to be the thing for which we work. I mean, to gain that, at least to some extent, that always fascinated me. And for me, the debt crisis of the early 1980s was an experience that made me a development economist first before I became a political economist of monetary integration, on which I work. And so I realized that there is a kind of everyday experience with money, but this is, I think, not what money really is. The money that, or what I would say money is that money that we call central bank money, fiat money, money that's created, and we use it, and it depends on the trust that you can always pay something with it, in particular, get rid of your obligations. And this is how that money, and it will link to something I hope that Philip later says, this money is not so much a means of exchange as textbook economics would say to you, you know, we had this clever invention. When we have a barter economy, then we always need this double coincidence of wants. So when we want to exchange something, I have to want what you have and you have to want what I can exchange. So let's take a general means of exchange. That reduces our transaction costs. Now, that sounds terribly plausible. It's just there is no historical evidence for it that this is how money came about. Money was very early on actually a creation probably of the temple, where it was, so that money that I mean, a fiat money, a money that isn't pointing to something else that you can get for it, that was the receipt for sacrificing at the temple. So a receipt for showing that shows that you have fulfilled an obligation. And money today comes into the economy by a bank saying, I go into debt vis-a-vis the central bank. And that central bank charges immediately an interest rate on that. And this leads to further transactions, a whole edifice of credit and deposits and savings is built on that. That is then the business that banks themselves do. But the important thing is money came into as something that can extinguish, that shows that you extinguished an obligation, while all other these means of payments that banks create always depend on that somebody else accepts the obligation that it shows. So think of a check that's drawn on your deposits, on your savings. It depends on you. The claim that you have on the bank is reduced if you write a check that pays your rent or whatever, but that the debt is not out of the way. It transfers to somebody else who holds now the claim on your bank for that payment. And so you can't extinguish with all these other bank means. Debt doesn't get rid of the economy, but when you pay in cash, which is the money that we know, banks themselves have also an account with the central bank, and that's their central bank money. That is something that really can extinguish debt, and I think that is the main characteristic that can explain all these recent phenomena that we had, for example, that banks were running into the central banks and wanted to hold masses of that absolute liquidity. I leave it at that.
Now, you asked me to jump in if you used a technical term. Could you just explain for us a little bit more the distinction between fiat money, central bank money, and ordinary money? Are they two different kinds of money?
So fiat money is the money which we say is no longer commodity money. That would be the counter thing. So where the state authority basically says, this I call the legal tender, you can pay basically any contract with that. And our prices, everything is denominated in that thing. That still has to be accepted. We know economists that have dollarized or euroized economies, but in general, in a functioning monetary system, it's just based on this. The government says this is the means of payment. When people didn't trust so much, especially when the rulers abused the ability to issue money, usually people wanted to have that be covered with something like gold or some metal, something that couldn't be so easily produced and therefore reined in the money creating powers of and the abuse of the money creating power of the ruler. So that would be the difference. And then I have the distinction between central bank money, so that money that central banks issue, that's on the one hand cash that you all hold in your purses, and every bank that has access to the central bank has an account with it. That itself is also central bank money. We don't have access to that, but that's part of the money supply by the central bank. And on that, banks have started to build, you know, their own means of payment that we also sometimes call money in a wider sense. For example, checks that you draw on your deposit. That is also can be called money, but I would say it's a different kind of money. And if you mix up the two things, you cannot quite explain why there was such a recent, in a crisis, such a run into central banks. Why should they have done this if you know, that's all equivalent ways of having money?
Philip, let's hear from you.
Well, I largely agree with Valtrald, and but I think I'd want to say, when I think about money, what we have to think about first of all is its role as a unit of account. It's what we use to measure things with, and in particular, it's what we use to measure our contracts with. So if, when we stipulate what a debt is, we normally specify, pay a certain amount of money, buy a certain amount of time. So as a unit of account and as a standard for future payments, I think is where we identify what money is. And so money is, as we've just heard, it's what would cancel a debt. It's usually possible, but it's not necessary, to use a kind of representation of that unit of account in as a means of payment or as a way of storing value. But I'd want to distinguish between a representation, which is a mere sign. I have one here. It's just a piece of paper. It's just a mere sign of some sort of value that exists goodness knows where, and it can be used as a store of value. But money itself is perhaps, or the value of money, is just a concept that's a convention that we have institutionalized, and so we all use it. So I think we can actually distinguish between three rather different kinds of money. There are notes and coins, which are issued by the central bank. The coins don't really possess the value in their metal that is on their face. So they're in a way that they're a different kind of token to the paper. The paper doesn't possess any value really significantly, nor the new plastic £5 notes. No significant value there. They're just signs. They're just representations of a value. But the interesting thing about them is that they're tangible. You know, you can believe there's something here because I can hand it over. it's something that makes it feel concrete, even though it's just an idea in our collective heads. Now, different from that is what is mainly used in our economy, which is records held by banks or bank deposits, various kinds. Some of these you can only access after a certain time. Some of them you can access immediately. Are the two different? I don't want to get into that. But largely, these are just records. And there's this marvelous way of producing this kind of money. You know, if I take out a mortgage, I bought a house in July, so I took out a mortgage, and I've got this asset, this capacity now to buy a house, but I've also got this liability. I've got to keep paying my mortgage. And the two cancel each other out. And the bank decides, right, we'll give you, we have this asset now of your mortgage, but we're liable. We have to pay your solicitor. It was Nationwide. They paid my solicitor the sum of the mortgage, which then gets transferred to another bank. And this kind of banking money, commercial bank money, is what largely is used as a means of exchange in the financial system. It's just a matter of recording transactions in a way, ordering them, recording them. But the last stage is, as we've just heard, is the third kind, is central bank reserves. Now, when I last looked in September, and I may have remembered this figure wrong, the Bank of England states that there are 168 institutions in the sterling monetary framework. That is, there are 168 institutions that are allowed to have reserve accounts with the Bank of England. And usually, to get those reserve accounts, they have to lend something to the Bank of England, such as UK Treasury bonds. And in return, they get back the central bank reserve, which they only use for settlement between those institutions at the end of the day. So it's clearing. It's the operation of clearing, settling off debts, cancelling them out. This one cancels that, which cancels that, cancels that, cancels that. Only a small difference at the end of the day. And it's a clearing transaction, which means that a reserve is moved from one account to another. Never leaves the Bank of England. We shouldn't necessarily think of it as money at all. If there's more of it, if there's less of it, it doesn't make a direct influence on the economy. There's lots of, all sorts of indirect influences. And I think that together, well, the difference between them, one is tangible. It's a sign. It's something concrete. You can easily transfer it. The bank money is easily created when you take out debts. It's easily just recorded, a change in the figures. So it's easily produced. It's not really scarce. And then central bank reserves are there to organise trust. So money holds value ultimately because we need a central bank, because we need trust. We need some way of organising this system of exchange.
I want to pick up on something that you said and Susan said, and I wonder if there's sort of general consensus on the panel. Susan, you talked about having a realisation that money was, in a sense, made up, and that being quite liberating, a liberating experience. And Philip, you were talking about money being just a concept or just a convention. Valtrad, I suppose I'm sort of looking at you. Would you agree with that, that there's something perhaps not real about money, or do you think it does have a bit more reality than that that we could try to explain?
Well, it makes us all work and produce and so on, because, you know, I mean, people, the economy starts with a debt. That's what I just said. In a way, you could think of, on debt builds in the credit cycle, and the credit cycle is an obligation on the economy to actually produce something that even can have an interest rate. Mm-hmm. I would call it a social institution, but that's, you can say that's just a convention. It's true. But it's very real in its effects.
We have lots of institutions that are just conventions. The London School of Economics is just a concept in our heads, but it's a very useful one, because on the basis of that, we can build buildings and we can come together and meet and have conversations. We do all sorts of things. We organise our life through kinds of conventions in this way. But we can decree certain institutions are null and void and stop using them, but largely they're what we use to organise our lives with.
So when you say it's just a convention, that's not to belittle it, but just to say, distinguish it from other forms of reality, like the physical paper that it's printed on.
All the interesting aspects of reality are human conventions and not what happens in the stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Susan, do you agree with that? I sense that you might be more on the kind of sort of, if we can say, anti-realist side of this. You know, money is made up. You know, that's quite a statement.
Well, I suppose, I mean, a specific example is the institution of interest is a convention that we've kind of invented. That's a very human invention, I think. The idea that any money that we have deserves to accumulate in value in the future. That is a convention that seems to be almost universally accepted at the moment. But I don't think that's always been the case. And there are examples of people trying to create money systems without interest. And an example I quite like is the idea that actually, in nature, we don't have the same process. You know, in general, there are some. I guess that's why I've used gold as a backing for money, because it doesn't really devalue, and it doesn't rot or de-exist. But in most natural systems and ecosystems, things do break down and decay, and that's how ecosystems work. And yet our financial systems are based on the opposite process. They're based on this process of constant accumulation. So I do think this is a very important man-made construct in our financial system, this idea of accumulation. And there's some really cool examples of alternative currencies where people have built monetary systems where the currency doesn't accumulate, where it actually devalues. So you can't use money to store value. You can only use it to exchange it with other people. And I think that's a really interesting idea that perhaps its time has come, as we're entering a period of negative interest rates at the moment. So interesting times ahead.
So to the extent that it's a convention, we're able to ask the question whether it works for us and whether it could be potentially changed. I mean, that's presumably what you were trying to do with the Brixton Pound, or have I got that
wrong?
Yeah,
on a much more mini level. So the Brixton Pound is linked to sterling. So to get Brixton Pounds, you have to change some sterling for the currency. We did have a bit of a period where we tried making the exchange rate not one for one, so you got more Brixton pounds. But that worked for the people buying it, but it got a bit complicated for changing it back into sterling. So, but actually, once you've got Brixton pounds, you can't bank them, and so businesses are taking a currency that they can't accrue interest on. They're generally agreeing to accept a currency because they want to respend it in the community. And a lot of business owners, I was surprised, were really into this idea, actually. So, and that's something that, for me, was probably the best thing about the currency, is realising that lots of small business owners who obviously want to make a profit and want to keep their business going are also really interested in supporting the community and, you know, quite willing to take on this quite radical idea.
Are you nodding in agreement, or maybe slightly sceptical?
No, I mean, I would reflect on the question why it remained a small idea. And I'm not surprised that the small shop owners are interested. I mean, they're natural little Keynesians, and I understand that they would like us to constantly spend. And, you know, I'm a unreconstructed Keynesian, so I'm not saying that to belittle that in any way. But what if we don't just want to spend all that money in Brixton? I mean, Silvio Gesell, who had this idea first, and actually was more radical than you, he had a negative interest rate on it. He said this lazy money that people hoard should be devalued. You know, you get a stamp duty on it all the time, and it degenerates in value if you don't spend it. Well, that's nice for the shops, but for us customers, I mean, I'm not sure.
I think there's, like, if you were to really, like, start from scratch and design the monetary system again, there are lots of interesting ideas. So one interesting idea is that you might have different types of currencies for different things. And I think what is interesting about a currency like the Brixton Pound is actually there are some transactions that it will make a lot more sense, some services that we want to maybe relocalise or have much more spending of them. So when there's so many resources in the community that aren't being used, it'd be really great to have more currencies to be able to enable people to trade in those resources. So particularly services, particularly people that have got, skills like looking after children or all of these sort of things we might want to trade more of in a community, and some things we might want to trade less. So particularly with all the issues around climate change and use of natural resources, there are some things we might want to ration, and that's where it might be useful to have more than one type of currency. However, when you start trying to design a whole system from scratch, then you're into the kind of theoretical land that no one wants to buy into. So I think the more interesting thing about the currency, like a Brixton Pound, is to get people to start questioning these big issues of what money is and actually what things we should be controlling more locally and what things we should be controlling more globally.
Well, we're already starting to get onto the territory of the second question that we wanted to discuss. Not what is money, but whether money works for us. It seems straightforward that the more money you have, the better off you will be. But you can ask a more general question of whether our system of money makes us better off. And I suppose, Susan, you've been suggesting that, you know, that's an important question that we should at least raise rather than just take for granted that the current system that we have is bound to make us better off. Valtra, can we start with you on this question?
Yeah, I mean, that is a question that John Maynard Keynes, he was actually a monetary economist all his life. People always think he only thought about employment and was very dismissive of money, but all from the early Indian currency reform, he throughout, there's always money in every big work he written. And he was exactly asking, why is it sometimes not working for us? There is a saying you may have heard, if you are German, it's ascribed to Kurt Tucholsky. If you're an American, it's probably Mark Twain, because every good line is by Mark Twain and so on and so forth. You may have an English Churchill probably here. The saying is, the Phoenicians invented money, but why only so little? And the saying indicates something, namely that we always feel we are constrained by the money we can muster to go in a shop. In capitalism, think of Dickens' Christmas Carol, these little poor children who look into these shops. The shops are full, but we all collectively don't buy them empty. It was actually an experience I had when I was in Berlin and the wall came down in 1989, that these East Germans came over from East Berlin. And you hear them saying in the shops, look how full everything is. They couldn't quite understand how is it that the shops are always full of commodities when that is the thing we want and we don't buy it. We don't queue to get it because that was always the scarcity they had. The goods were not there. They had a lot of money, but, you know, not enough to buy with it. And prices were controlled. And this is the thing why money often doesn't work for us. Because in capitalism, it, as I said earlier, it comes into existence through the banking system and immediately has an interest rate on it. This interest rate means only productions get credit that promise to at least pay back that interest rate, usually more than that central bank interest rate, namely a margin for the banks themselves. It's a kind of tax on every production that takes place in a capitalist economy. And so there are situations in which the trust of the banks that credit comes back with an interest is so low that they don't finance investments, even though there are plenty of people queuing for jobs, plenty of good projects. Even the four of us could just think up and would be saying that would really increase our living standards and so on. But the money supply and the credit in particular that builds on it is the constraint on the economy that holds everything else, is the gatekeeper to investment, employment, and so on and so forth. And this is, in a nutshell what bothered John Maynard Keynes about capitalist economies, and that he essentially analyzed as monetary economies, and where he said in the end, especially when you have these deflationary, depressionary times, central banks push on a string, you actually need the government, the fiscal authority to come in and create that demand that then gets the economy going and make banks trust again that investments pay off. That's why.
Great. Susan, does that chime with some of the things you were saying earlier, or would you want to disagree with some of that?
I mean, to some extent, I suppose I've really changed my views on this quite a lot recently because I guess I got really interested in the 2008 crisis and the response of the government, and I kind of was quite critical of the banking system. And I suppose the argument that I'd heard a lot and that I proposed was that things went wrong in like the 1980s when banking sort of took over. That's what I thought. But then I started leading walking tours around the City of London. And my new view is that actually, maybe other people would agree with this, but that actually it all started going wrong a couple of hundred years earlier, which is when that's when banking really went crazy in London. That's
usually
when we started.
We start with Adam and Eve. That's everything.
Maybe. But, I mean, so specifically, the system that we've inherited that I think we've invented today really started like in the when institutions like the Bank of England were founded in the late 17th century. And in London, all these sort of things happened. The Bank of England was founded. We had the stock markets. We had one of the first corporations to be founded, the East India Company. These were the institutions that I think really shaped our modern economy we have today. And actually, I think these institutions and the banking system that they've was founded has actually led people in the West to do quite well. And this is the part of the narrative that I think is sometimes missing from the left. So I was going to show some pictures, but maybe it's not necessary. Because it kind of shocked me when I first saw pictures of currencies from around the world, which all look very similar to sterling, because they've all got our current Queen's face on. So currencies that were used to trade in countries in Africa have got our Queen's face on, and these were used up until the 1960s. So actually, I don't know if I've made this very clear, but the point I'm trying to make is that actually the financial system that we might critique was developed hand in hand with the British Empire, and all of these institutions, I think, have benefited the West quite a lot. And rather than it necessarily being a problem that money is created as debt, the problem is which countries in the world have been able to borrow at low rates of interest and maintain these debts. And which countries in the world, if they get into debt, people start panicking. And actually, we've had this massive privilege in the UK where we've been able to get into debt, and nobody's really asked for the money back. The US has the same privilege. They're in a lot of debt, but nobody's asking them to pay it back. And I really think this is the biggest challenge we have at the moment, because things are changing. You know, I'm not sure this situation is sustainable for very much longer. And I don't know if I've got a very positive, that was a very positive conclusion, but I think I'll just stop talking.
Great. Well, I'm sure there's going to be lots of debate on this, but let's just turn to Philip first.
Yes, I entirely agree. In works I've written, I've argued that the problem starts with the Bank of England, but I want to qualify that now and advance on my next thing. What came before the Bank of England was possibly even worse, because in England in particular, the coinage was in a terrible state. There wasn't much of it. It tended to be hoarded and used for big transactions. Nearly every transaction took place by credit, deferred payment. Oh, I'll pay you later. I'll get the money later. And then eventually a few people could meet and say, oh, I owe you this, you owe me that, you owe me that. We'll cancel it out. Process of reckoning. So we have this system, which is, you know, it sounds all very worthy. It sounds like a bit like the Brixton pound without the accounting mechanism. But the problem with it is, if you lend money to some worthy neighbour who then gets into trouble, their harvest doesn't come in, a relative dies, etc., etc., you don't get the payment you expect, then you're in trouble. And there's a process of debt contagion, exactly like the bank's experience in 2008. Only it's going on for everyone. And I think back in the 1580s, going back that far, there were so many court cases going on in England that there were as many in a year as there were households in the country. Nearly every household was affected by some sort of debt contagion. And this didn't diminish until after the financial revolution, after the creation of the Banking of England, when people could at least pay up with worthless paper notes, because instead of trusting their neighbour to say, I'll pay you in three months' time, or 3 years' time, they can accept the Bank of England's promise, because they know the Bank of England is backed by the state, which is going to collect taxes. So, why? I think this leads to a kind of bubble economy, and it's partly because of interest, but there are other reasons. So I would see the whole of modernity as a kind of banking bubble. Now, money is great. It makes us better off when we receive it, But not only when we receive it, but also when we spend it or invest it. If we just keep it, we can't do anything with it. It's useless. It's useless to have it under the mattress. So money makes us better off when we receive it or when we spend it. So the key thing is where money goes. To whom does it go? Does it come back to you, or does it always flee you and never to return? And I think there's certain inequalities built into the way in which the economy is structured. So if we start with different places where money could, you could think of money starting, it could be, say, the state spends it on handing out benefits or funding schools and hospitals, funding salaries, or you could say when people take out mortgages, private debt's created. This money goes somewhere. You know, people buy things with it. It goes to retailers. They pay producers, suppliers. It goes into more wages. People spend it again, and it goes round and round and round. But it doesn't keep on going round and round and round, because with most of the transactions, VAT, income tax, corporation tax, the state takes a cut. So it goes back to the state. And yet, we know that our state is running a national deficit, which means it never gets as much money back as it spends, not in taxes anyway. So where else does it go? Well, this is the nature of capitalism. If there's an interest rate, if there's a dividend on shares, for example, then, and if the people in the middle take a kind of cut, then there's another extraction. It's not taxation, but it's money is extracted, siphoned off, and it goes into the financial system. And what do they do with it? They buy treasury bonds. So actually they do hand over the money back to the state, but in return they own a little bit of the state in the form of the debt's obligation to them. So they've got to keep being paid interest. And the whole system never reaches any kind of balance and equality. And on this basis of these, you know, these lovely liquid assets like central bank reserves, treasury bonds, you have a whole pyramids of different kinds of financial products, different kinds of debts being created, different kinds of trades. And it's as though this value is in many different places at the same time. But ultimately, it's all a kind of debt. So I think if you follow the money, you find that there's a system in which it starts off as an unequal arrangement. You know, most money is created as debt, and therefore there's a creditor, there's a debtor. You know, I'm obliged. My bank might let me live in my house, but I'm obliged to pay my bank for my mortgage. So there's an unequal power relationship there. And that unequal power relationship gets amplified and amplified. And then when you use money for speculative purposes, I think most money, I might be wrong about this and I haven't found any research on it, but I think most money doesn't keep on going round and round. It ends up in the account of a large corporation. They're usually very cash rich. Or a money market fund, or a pension fund, or some kind of investment fund. Speculators hold large cash balances so that if an opportunity comes up, they can pounce, or if they get a margin call, they can pay up, or something like that. So there are certain places where money accumulates, and it doesn't keep on going round and round. So the problem is, how do you redistribute it? How do you get it back so that it starts meeting basic human needs?
In part of what you were saying, you sort of painted this financial services sort of sector as a kind of drain, which is sort of place where money ends up and doesn't get sort of recycled into the economy. Susan, perhaps would you kind of agree with that picture as well?
To some extent, but the other thing we've got to be clear about is that it is in terms of the proportion of our what we're producing in the UK, it's our biggest product, it's our biggest export is financial services. So it isn't as much. I used to believe it was a complete drain and we could just get rid of the whole banking system, we'd all be fine. But now I'm more concerned about how dependent on finance we are. And we have been for hundreds of years, but particularly, and it has been the case for the last 100 years, our biggest export has always been kind of financial services and insurance services. Mm-hmm. But
I think there's a bit of a we've got to be careful in being too critical of the banking system, given actually how dependent on we are on it for getting our tax base and for slightly propping up our trade deficit, but not very much.
And for other reasons. I mean, in a way, it's true to some extent that's only the idea of capitalism. It's sometimes not quite true. But in capitalism, you need a good business idea and convince a banker to give you credit. And then the whole cycle of generating income, buying resources that you put into things that we value more highly than what went into it, and therefore, I mean, that creates the richness of capitalism, that you did not have to be rich, land rich, whatever, in order to be able to produce, which is the case in feudalism and so on. So in that sense, that in functioning capitalist economies, and you were quite right, Susan, to point out that it's actually where you pay the low interest rates and where, you know, there is a trust in the currency that may come from 200 years ago, and unfortunately some of the African nation states were not existing at that point. Actually, we had suppressed them. Mm-hmm. That reputation helps us still to be in that much better position, but it shows you if you have a functioning capitalist economy, I mean, it provides chances to many people. One little thing I would like to say, it sounded, Philip, when you talked about the problems of public finances that we tend to have in most OECD countries, a continuous deficit. I'm not sure that has anything to do with money, because, I mean, we're talking about income, revenue streams, and so on. That's not money. Money itself is a stock that can go round many times. You know, every pound that we have somewhere in our purse is transacted over perhaps 10 times a month. I don't know exactly. And that generates each time an income stream that builds on that. That becomes somebody's wages, profits, whatever. That itself is not the money. That's the income generated by the use of money. So, and the revenue and the expenditure of a government are also not money as such. That is income that comes to the state and that is also spent again, for which one doesn't, you had earlier yourself explained, one doesn't need really cash for that. This can all be bank transactions and just from one balance sheet to the next, without ever having a tangible money flow.
Right. Yeah, just one final point, and then we're going to bring in our audience.
Okay. I did a back-of-the-envelope calculation recently. If you look at the average amount of fresh debt, the increase in private debt that has been taken out over the past 8 or 10 years in the UK, and you think of that as a certain sum of money that is newly created, that if that money changed hands 66 times in a year, it would account for the whole of the UK GDP. So we know it doesn't, because there's last year's new debt still in existence that is also going round. So if it's less than 66 times, it's not 10 times a month, it might be fast at first, but it slows down. Eventually it comes to rest somewhere. That's what I was thinking about when I was saying, well, where does it end up? If you follow an actual real unit of money, the one that I got from Nationwide, that went to my solicitor, that went to the person I bought a house from, or rather to his bank, and then he presumably paid off some debts, so some of that got cancelled. But where does the remainder go?
Just think about it. One of the students in this room has a scholarship that is so low that probably what the student gets in a month as that scholarship, their income just is spent again. There is no debt involved. And given our modern students, they typically use credit cards. They may not even use much cash. So, you know, with very little cash use, money use, that student has month after month an income, that scholarship, and spends it on coffee and whatever a student spends his or her money on, or her income on. and uses very little money in the process, and no debt is involved because it just balances the books. It's at that level.
We must open it up because I'm sure people are wanting to get in. If you do, you have a comment or question, please raise your hand and I'll make sure the microphone comes to you. I'm probably going to take two or three questions or comments in succession and then invite the panel to comment on those. There's a gentleman in the fourth row.
I'm interested to know whether you think fractional reserve is important in that it is decided by the state what is the multiple of lending that a bank can do, but it's the way in which money is created in the banking system. And secondly, I want to ask whether you think that the increased speed of circulation that has been made possible by the digitization of most money transactions and therefore the increased speed of circulation means that there is a multiple of this fraction of this multiple reserve increasing the amount of money in ways that I think can be shown to have been very dangerous in 2008. But I wondered what you thought about that.
Okay, we're going to take some questions in a row. If there's anybody else with a question, then please raise your hand. There's a gentleman right at the back on the right-hand side as you go up.
Hi there. Actually, just following on from the gentleman at the front's question around the velocity of money again, and I think there's something about how dependent are we on continuing to reduce the friction in money between buyers and sellers. And on the flip side, what dangers do you see associated with that? Because as the financial crisis showed, allowing money to move too quickly causes a lot of big problems. So I just wonder if there's any comments in the panel about that. How do we make it quicker? What's the benefit? You know, obviously, there is benefits, but of course, on the other side, the risks associated with it.
Okay. I think we can squeeze in one more. Yeah, there's a gentleman right in the middle here with his hand up all the way down in the fourth row from the front.
Can you pass it along? Hi, I'm curious as to why the panel think we call the financial statements balance sheets. If the panel think they don't have to balance, yet the minute an institution is found not to balance its balance sheet, it's declared bankrupt.
Great. So feel free, panel, to dive in on any of these. There was a question about fractional reserve and what the right multiple of lending should be. There's a couple of questions about the increased speed of circulation of money and perhaps a provocative question about this phrase, the balance sheet, final balance. Quite technical questions, I suppose.
Perhaps I can start on this fractional reserve. So fractional reserve banking means whenever the bank, so the banks, it, the easiest way to think about it goes to the central bank. It wants to do credit business, so it gets that fraction of cash that may be required to give the credit, but in principle it can also just say, so yes, you have an overdraft facility here, you firm that wants to do some investment. A lot of this, because it never, you know, any of these payments, so wages are paid, some paper, some rent for the firm's premises and so on are paid, a lot of that comes always back to the banking system, even to the same bank. So the same bank can then lend out, again, these things that it has generated out of nothing, if you will, central bank as fiat money being that nothing, that comes back. And so it could, in principle, lend out again and again. And the more it does, the more it is able to lend again and again. So to slow that down, one can say, against each new lending, you have to hold some reserve. There were some of these monetary critics that said 100% should be the reserve, so then they cannot do this credit multiplying. This is the credit multiplier rests on that. I think this is an important instrument that central banks in the last 20 years forgot to have and to use for exactly the reasons that you say. When a boom is going, then this velocity can go ever faster. The problem was a bit, and you know, these central bankers are not stupid, so that they need me to tell them that. Given that we had in these low interest times, banks were so inventive with their financial innovations that when you try to rein something in, say with a higher reserve requirement, they invented some other means of payment. So, and that is our problem. How to hold them back when they, to their own detriment, go into this overkill. But, and that's an answer to this follow-up question further up the seats. Yes, we can say things move too quickly, but whether that's always money or these other, you know, selling and buying assets and so on, it has built on this, is another matter. And actually, in the recent crisis, we had the problem that there was too little turnaround. That however much the central banks threw money at the banking system, they just held it as liquidity. And so there was too little circulation. That can also be a problem. It's called what Keynes called the liquidity trap, that everybody wants to hold more liquidity so that the interest rate that really reaches the economy, not the one that the central banks quoted them, it was zero and negative soon, the interest rate that the banks would charge to engage in any lending business was too high for the economy. So that is, there is an equilibrium that itself is not a fixed thing. And when it's too high and when it's too low, that's the boom-bust cycle, if you will. It's bad, that's true.
We can probably squeeze in another question.
This unbalanced thing I have not quite understood, so I can't answer that.
Keep your hand up if you have a... And you're going to jump in as well. Yeah, there's a gentleman all the way up, well, sort of halfway up in the white hat on the left.
Thank you. Given that you were advisors to Donald Trump, how would you create Trump money in order to satisfy the disenfranchised people who voted for him?
Thank you. And I think there was a question not far away. Yeah, the gentleman there with his hand up against the sitting right by the wall.
Thank you. I think you've all touched upon this issue, but maybe haven't pinned it on the head. And so I'll ask you the question quite directly. Will you admit this is a fraudulent system? It is a system of deceit. We call it, we need trust in money. We need confidence, and that's what it is. It is a con. The director, one-time director of the Bank of England himself, Josiah Stamp, himself said that money was created in inequity, and it was born in inequity and created in sin. And if you wish to remain the slaves of the bankers and pay for the cost of their own slavery, then let them continue to create deposits. So we admit this fact that many researchers have come to.
Thank you. And then let's just try to squeeze in one more. Yeah, there's a lady here in the grey jumper. Yeah. But you'll have to come around or pass it along, I'm afraid.
Thank you. I'm really interested to hear what you think might happen in 10 years, but then maybe even 100 years. Maybe this is too long a discussion for right now, but when we move towards a more cashless society, but then also in the future, hopefully when we move towards a society where there are fewer borders in between countries, you know. I'd just be interested.
Good.
Always hopeful. Yes, excellent.
Philip, I think I cut you off last time. You were poised to say something, so why don't you jump in?
Okay. 10 years' time, tight borders, wars breaking out. Sorry, I don't share your optimism. Because I don't have confidence in our banking system as enabling us to truly put our money where our mouth is Instead, we tend to put our mouth where our money is. So, and perhaps this will be part of the later discussion, the way in which our system works is it prioritizes the use of money to repay debts and to make profits. But that's not what's most important in life. That's just means to an end. But it seems to stop us from ever getting really to grips with the end, because it's more important to deal with the means, because otherwise the whole system will collapse. And so as a fragile system, it dominates us through our fragility. So what should Trump do? He won't do this, and I'm slightly reluctant to go on record to do this, but I'm rather attracted to the idea of a universal basic income, that first of all, we send money out to everyone because everyone has needs, and what we really want money to do is to meet people's needs or help them to meet their own needs. So if you send it out to everyone, it'll end up in all sorts of odd places, and we suck it back in and distribute it back to everyone. Should I say anything about the previous questions?
Yeah, please do if you want to.
I'll try and keep it brief.
Feel free to cherry pick a little bit.
I feel that the problem is not simply the fractional reserve money or the velocity of money. I think the velocity of money is a bit of a misnomer, because the thing about money is it's mine or it's yours. You know, it just changes in a blink of an eye. It doesn't move. It doesn't flow like water flows. So it's either mine or yours. So you can talk about frequency of money transactions. Frequency is that good? It's not a problem in itself. What I think the central problem is a certain kind of liquidity or capital flight, which means if things are getting bad, we're going to get our money out. There's always somewhere else to put your money. We're going to get it out of here. And the nature of basic economic relations is they're not instantaneous exchanges like that. They're usually contracts. They're enduring relationships of mutual dependence, mutual obligations. And to try and convert that through securitization into something that can be changed over time and time and time again really quickly is a way of enabling a kind of capital flight. And it's because of the risk of capital flight that our governments have no autonomy over their economic policy. They only have to do what the bond market approves of, which might not even be what's in the bond market's interests.
Great. Any other comments from the panel? Otherwise, I'll move us on.
I would briefly like to take up this saying, it is a system of deceit, and we need a money that we can trust. I mean, I do not like the inequality that is created, but you cannot, deny that the richest countries in the world and the best living standards are in the capitalist, in the capitalist area, and as Susan earlier said, where actually capitalism was almost invented. And we have to take that seriously too. As social scientists, you have to explain that as well. And just to take the last crisis, a crisis that in debt, to that extent, that depth, and the geography where it happened, namely in the OECD world, nobody had expected, had not thought that is possible. It was a deeper crisis, according to many indicators, than the Great Depression. And yet, not a single saver until the Cyprus crisis, where it was imposed on the Cyprus government, until then, not a single saver has lost money. This is, if you had told me that before, if you had told any economist before, that this is possible, that this banking system collapses in this systemic way, and yet the savings are safe, the central banks come out like nobody had expected, creative, that you wouldn't think these men in grey suits are able to be creative like that, nobody would have expected that. And you can still go in any shop and pay with that money. What is the deceit you mean? I mean, it is a quite interesting, admirable institution that we keep the trust in something that, you know, the edifice, the financial system that builds on it, had just collapsed and had failed miserably, miserably. I hope you're still as critical as you always were vis-à-vis the banking system. But still, the institution of money fulfilled its functions.
And so I do not agree that this is a system of deceit. We do still trust in it, otherwise it wouldn't function.
Can I just quickly come in on the idea of the richest, the most successful countries being capitalist countries? Because I think I'm not sure I quite agree. I think the most successful and richest countries are the countries that use capitalism to pursue imperial means. So, you know, Britain got very rich, I think, because we used the Bank of England's early loans, which were to the monarch, to build up the British Navy. And I think that this is how Britain actually got rich. I think prior to Britain being involved in places like India, they were doing pretty well. So India was the workshop of the world before we pursued a particular trade policy with India. And we don't really know what was happening in Africa because we didn't really make any proper records of all the different things that were happening there. And I think there's quite a lot of hypocrisy in us saying that capitalism is working. We developed a system that is quite literally burning the planet. So I don't think I agree with that argument about capitalism. Also, China's doing pretty well. It's not capitalism as we'd normally define it. So I think that a lot of our narratives around, I don't know, it's state capitalism, but I don't know. So I think there's quite a lot of things about... Perhaps touched on it earlier, but it wasn't quite clear. I think that the actual reason that some currencies have been so powerful is because the current countries issuing them have got an army to back up that power.
Right. We do have a final question that we wanted to touch on. We've been moving from ontology to ethics. We started off with this question, what is money? And we got quite quickly to whether money is useful or good for us. So questions of value. And just the final question I want us to focus on is this question of money and value. It often appears to us that money is somehow value neutral. It's completely fungible. It can be exchanged for anything, whatever your value system is. Everybody needs money in order to promote it. But is there some more intrinsic connection between money and value? Philip, perhaps you can start us off.
I'd like to suggest that there is, and the connection is primarily that money makes us focus on one set of valuable things and makes us tend to ignore or devalue other valuable things. Let me try and explain. I think there are going to give you three kinds of goods in life, three kinds of goods. Firstly, there are things that we can separate out and treat as distinct, separate, individual objects which we can possess. So I ate an apple in a cafe. I paid for it, 50 pence. Don't know if that's good value. I ate it. I don't think any of you would want to eat the same apple now. So if it's mine, it's not yours. And that's the way we treat private property. They're valuable things that we call our possessions. If it's mine, then it can't be yours. So that's one kind of good that exists in life. But another kind of good is something that's collective that we can only have if we participate in it. So, for example, a public discussion only works if we all kind of participate and follow the rules of a public discussion. And even I shut up sometimes, and you lot are quiet most of the time, then at least we can have some kind of, a certain kind of imbalanced in power public conversation. And this is a good of participation. Most of our institutions are like this. You have to follow the procedures, the conventions, the rules of an institution. And in a sense, the Brixton pound is used because people want this collective common good. We want thriving small businesses at Brixton, people thought. Therefore, we'll use it because this will keep our money in Brixton and so we'll be transacting with each other and it will help us thrive. That's a collective use of money. It's a common good. So there are these goods of participation. They can only be mine if they're also yours. We participate in them collectively. Now, these are commonly described, these two goods. But I won't suggest there's a third kind, which is individual, but it's also to do with relations. And I'll give you an example of this, and it's time.
the time that I have is given to me. I don't make it. It's given to me. I've no choice about it. I've given my time. And I only have that time by spending it. I can spend it on myself. I can spend it on being with a friend. I can spend it in all sorts of ways. But I have that time by spending it. So only, I only have it by, you know, offering it in a way. It's in the nature of reality that I have to offer, spend, give away my time. Likewise, in a strange way, the value of money, the value of this, this is useless. This has been sitting in my pocket probably for 5 or 6 weeks. Perfectly useless. That's why I keep throwing it at Peter. But if I spend it, then I can realise its value. And some of the core things in life, care, attention, love, perhaps life itself, is only what we spend. So I call this kind of good a good of offering. We only have it by giving it away, spending it on something. Now, the thing about the goods of participation and the goods of offering is we can't easily quantify them or possess them. And what money is really useful for, as a unit of account, is saying, right, if we limit, delimit this thing here, then we can even do it to time in a certain way. We'd limit time as a working hour and associate with that and payment per hour. But that's not the experience of spending time. That's different. That's what happens. It's just an idea if you say, I'm going to pay you this much for this working hour. Anyway, money makes us focus on goods of appropriation, things we can possess, because they can be compared with each other, and therefore we can arbitrarily assign values to them, and because we use money as a means of exchange. And I think there's two issues here that help the use of money make us forget the other values. One is debt, and the other is natural selection. If we're in debt, and a lot of us are, or we deal with institutions that are in debt, then one of our most urgent concerns, if we're going to continue as we are, is to get hold of money which we use to pay off our debts, or pay our rent, or pay our taxes, or whatever it is. So the use of money makes us focus on acquiring money, and that has to be a sort of priority before we can then get on to the other values. You know, you need to have time before you can spend it. So that's one dynamic through which money, particularly if we create it as debt, becomes a self-reinforcing thing that we know you just use it to get more and more money so you can pay off your debts. But the other is this kind of logic of natural selection, because what happens in life is largely determined by what people spend money on. Who are the people who have the most money to spend? They're the wealthy. How do people use their money if they're wealthy? They use it to make money. So money that is used to make money becomes much more predominant and important. And people who don't use money to make money, they spend it as soon as they get it, they don't really have a significant influence on what goes on in the wider world. So there's this kind of process of natural selection that money seems to, when you use it, it seems to posit itself as the most important value, because it's the means through which we make our values come true, the means in which we realise our values. So the value we have to realise above all else is making money. And this, I feel, is not value neutral, because it makes us tend to forget, and even in some theoretical discourses, completely eliminate the goods of participation and the goods of offering, which are much more, or is equally central to our life. No, they're not equally, because you can't use equally, because we're outside the realm of comparison. But they are central to our lives as well.
Thank you, Philip. We are short of time, so let's bring in the other two panellists, and we'll try to get some time for questions.
Yeah, I really like the way you described like time and some as goods of offering. That's a really interesting way to think about things. And I suppose, I had some experience of working on this thing called a time bank, which you might have heard of the idea. It's where you try and facilitate a bank where all of the exchange unit is time. So if somebody does something for the time bank, if they say, like for example, do some gardening in someone's house and they spend 2 hours on the gardening, they've earned 2 time credits and they spend those time credits on someone else's time in the bank. And this is a great idea because, as you've already said, time is something that everybody has more or less in equal amounts. Everybody's got 24 hours in a day. So in general, you could create a much more equal world if we traded in time. However, of course, lots of problems in that some skills take more in demand than others. But the idea is really interesting. But the problem I noticed when I was working on the time bank in this housing association is that even if you try and take the national currency away, the values of the national currency are so embedded within us. So people that have been out of work for a while often believe their skills not to be useful, even if they have skills. So this kind of idea that you're not useful is really ingrained sometimes in our psyche. So actually, I think the values of money are very, very deeply embedded within ourselves. So time is just is one example. But the other value system of money, I think, is this idea of accumulation that I've already talked about. And I think that's another idea that we all kind of have in our psyche. Like, I think most people have this idea that they're going to achieve all these things in their life, they're going to be better than what their parents achieved, and they more than anything want their children to achieve even more than they've achieved. This is kind of us internalising the idea of economic growth in a weird sort of way. And I think it's something that, probably not a very popular thing to say, but I think we maybe need to be satisfied more with actually what we have, and that our children might have a similar standard of living to us, not necessarily that we're going to always consume more and have more things. And I think sort of like questioning these assumptions that we have in our psyche are quite important. And although they maybe come from our financial system, they've got quite deep into our core psychology.
I'll try.
I mean, I think most certainly money is not value neutral for the reasons some of them you mentioned, although I see it slightly differently. And not being value neutral doesn't distinguish money from any other social institution. So what kind of values does money project? I mean, I think by pricing things, it says on those things they are comparable, exchangeable, alienable, transferable. And that is sometimes, however, seen as something we should also limit. So while capitalism has in many ways introduced money in spheres through, for example, historically, again, the government imposing on the economy a tax that had to be paid in a particular currency. This was how Alexander Hamilton, the first finance minister of the United States, tried to introduce a first national currency and did not succeed. But in many other countries, this forced the peasant economy to become a monetized economy because they had this obligation to pay the tax. But we end commodification of labor. You know, that you're not the feudal workforce that lives on the estate and is just fed and housed and so on and clothed, the slave, but that you lend your time for a certain time and then get a wage, a money wage, and you can use that as you like. And, I mean, I would rather be a wage laborer than a slave. In fact, it's excluded today by law and creates a particular credit market imperfection for our students because they cannot go to the bank and say, I lend you my person and you dispose over me within the laws of, you know, appropriateness after I've done my studies here at LSE and that's how I pay you back. No, they would not be allowed to do that. You cannot enslave yourself and it creates a credit market imperfection. Because we exclude certain uses and certain penetrations of money into social spheres. You cannot buy a verdict from a judge. You cannot buy votes as a politician. You cannot buy public office. You have to follow other procedures. If you had a marriage in which you pay each other for marital services, I guess that marriage doesn't last very long, right? So we see money is quite penetrating, especially in the economy, but it has almost created the sense of there is an economic sphere in which money makes things very comparable, transferable, liquid. But there's other spheres that we actually very consciously separate from that. And in that sense, I would disagree with Philip that the money that has become such an important driver of economic activity, as I believe, in capitalism,
it has not imposed itself as the most important thing everywhere. We clearly distinguish where it has its role and where it shouldn't have its role, namely where it's corruption and all these other things that are pathologies of monetary use.
Thank you. I'm sure we could carry on a discussion here, but I do want to open it up because we've got sort of just about 10 minutes left. If you have a question or would like to make a comment, please raise your hand where I can see it. Yeah, there's a gentleman right at the front.
Can the panelists talk a little bit about currencies? Do you see a move towards more localized currencies, more and more currencies like the Brixton Pound? Or do you see a trend towards, you know, one currency world or, you know, moving towards more consolidation? How do you see that?
Thank you. And let's come to somebody else. Yes, yeah, gentleman in the fourth row. I keep coming to people in the fourth row. Apologies. For people sitting either side. Yeah. I'm pointing at... we'll come to you next.
It's not a question, it's actually just a comment. I think that money is basically like it derives its value from the goods and services in the economy. So I actually think like the problem is basically the interest, because when you take interest, you don't actually like... you don't actually increase the production of the economy. It's simply like a way to transfer wealth from like people who already have money. They're basically taking away money from those who don't have it. So, like, I was just wondering, what do you think about this?
Right, and we said we'd come to you behind, yeah.
Hello, hi. Sorry, I just got a quick question. There's a lot of technological change going on in the banks at the moment with the infusion of ownership rights within blockchain-based money technology. I was just wondering what your view is on how that would fundamentally change the nature of money if ownership rights are infused with individual currencies, because 97% of all the currency in the UK is owned by the bank.
Thank you. And let's take a question right over the other side of the lecture theatre, I'm afraid. Yeah, that'd be great. Right at the back on your right as you go up the last row.
What does the panel think of the Indian demonetization exercise?
And let's see if we can squeeze in just one more. Yeah, it's a gentleman in red.
Hi, I'm wondering, there's not been much said about like technology tonight, and earlier we mentioned how different, in this sort of theoretical world of a lot of different currencies, how we might have, say, child care as one end of the spectrum, and resources and the other, like climate, fossil fuels is on the other end of the spectrum. But there's this argument now about information as being something inherently not scarce at all, and whether this would need some sort of dramatic rethinking of how we relate money to commodities.
Thank you. Over to you, panel.
So many things. I suppose one thing that hasn't been mentioned, someone mentioned interest rates, but I actually think it would be more desirable if more money was, if interest rates were less important in a way. So if actually there was more equity finance, meaning that if projects were financed, not with a fixed rate of interest that you have to pay back, but if the people, if the creditors take on the risk of financing new projects rather than all the risk being borne by the debtor, which is what we have these fixed interest payments. And also, just to be clear, actually, interest rates are kind of zero at the moment in the UK for some people. They're zero if you want to buy a house. Not zero, but they're quite low if you want to borrow money to buy a house. They're pretty high if you want to borrow on any unsecured debt, if you've got a payday loan. Those rates of interest are quite high. They're even more unstable if you're a student now, because student loans are now not linked to interest rates. They're linked to the rate of inflation, which I found quite hard to believe that that's changed. So if you took out a student loan since, is it 2012, it changed, you now will pay back your loan linked to the rate of inflation, which is unfortunate for students because inflation is looking to rise quite dramatically
with Brexit. So that's a bit on interest rates. People are asked about whether the future will have more different types of currencies. Like, I sort of think the ideal world might be one where we do have lots of different currencies, where we have some currencies that maybe are these kind of information currencies, where you want to have lots more transactions of goods that don't have a high sort of carbon footprint. So you want to have lots more trade of services locally, lots more trade of skills, lots more trade of arts, and all of those things, and education would be great to have more exchanges of those type of things. And then maybe less, you want to have, limit the amount of currency for very carbon-intensive industries. But that's quite a complicated system to design, and I don't know what we're going to end up with. We might actually end up with just Amazon and Google having the only global currencies there are, which isn't a very, maybe not a very desirable future, but it might be the one that we're heading towards. I might stop there.
Okay, thank you. You've been very comprehensive. Other people want to jump in on any of these?
Yeah, I can say something on the currencies. I do not expect much of a trend either way. We see on the euro how difficult it is. I'm still a defender of the euro, if you are interested in that. But we see how difficult it is to organize it, because you need to make it happen. You can't just say, oh, yeah, we use now all a common currency. It has implications for how you do policy and so on and so forth. And the more diverse you are, the more difficult that gets, even though I think there's also benefits from being diverse. Bitcoins. I thought, you know, this question with blockchains and stuff like that. Decentralized money, it's called, I read the paper of one of our researchers. Dimitrios, are you still in the room? Then raise your hand, because you could talk. He's the expert. He does research on bitcoins, and I tried to read his article this afternoon. I'm still not clear what this is about, and to call it money, I'm not sure. It seems to me to be driven by people who want to hide transactions. There's nobody behind it. I'm told there's neither state nor the private sector behind backing this up when a crisis arises, so you can lose a lot of money. People hold it in expectation that this fixed supply raises the value of each unit, and so it's a speculative a thing for those who have not to hide a lot of, you know, money from very dark sources. So this whole thing, in my view, should be stepped out by central banks. I do not see any social purpose in this. And we know that it, at the same time, can, through social media and so on today, get into a scale that is really dangerous. Last, the demonetization exercise in India. Yes, that was an interesting experiment, and I think you can do that only once, because it came so surprising that, you know, it had an effect, and perhaps it was useful in trying to get out the black economy. But in an economy like India, and I happen to be a development economist in my first life that worked on India, what is black economy, grey economy, and just the poverty economy of people who struggle for their daily life is hard to say. And while I'm all in favour of getting the tax dodgers, it was a bit of a crude way of doing it, and I feared a lot of the consequences of that had to be borne by people that can ill afford such experiments with their use of money.
Philip, I think there's probably only one issue left for me to comment on, which is about information not being scarce and whether this will fundamentally change things. Well, I'd like to point out that disinformation is not scarce either, and is fundamentally changing things. And it seems to me that one of the current crises of the Western world is this surplus of information as well as disinformation. What is really scarce is thinking, which is to do with grounding information, finding reasons why it might be important and valuable. And I think there is a certain respect in which the most important things in life are pretty scarce. And that's not a problem. It might be a problem if they're goods of appropriation, but, you know, we want more and more goods of participation. But
we've only got so much life each, so that's pretty scarce and it's pretty valuable.
Thank you. Well, hopefully we've made thinking a little bit less scarce, but time is up, so it just remains to thank our panel and our audience for some really great questions.